You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report covering alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armon Rana.
I'm Zachary Tharpe.
And I'm Isa Yu. It's Thursday, November 21st at 5:04 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hankaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
We have a jam-packed show for you today. Later in the show, we hear from campus residents about their responses to the transit strike. I also caught up with Western Regional Director of Unifor, Gavin McGurgle. We wrap up the show with part two of our series on Criticare.
But first, we are introducing a new series on Democracy Watch, Why We March, about ongoing protests on campus. This week, we will speak with a UBC Hong Kong activist and give some background about the ongoing struggle there.
But first, some headlines.
The six-month-long listening phase of the citywide plan officially started at City Hall on November 14th. The idea was to start working on a plan with residents, especially First Nations and other minorities. The issues they intend to address include housing affordability, transportation, reconciliation, and the economy. And the city planners seem quite optimistic. However, some of those consulted were not impressed. Notably, at a meeting with Green Party councillor Pete Fry, Indigenous artists pointed out that the questions they were asked were quite generic and they didn't have anything to do with the arts community. Others also felt that their time and experience weren't being valued. More information about the citywide plan and opportunities for participation can be found at vancouverplan.ca.
From citywide plans to citywide newspapers, the free print edition of the Vancouver Star Metro will no longer be available to commuters starting December 20th of this year. The news was announced by John Boynton, president of Torstar, earlier this week. As a consequence, 73 employees across Canada will be laid off, including 33 journalists. This happened less than 2 years after the local daily paper known as Metro was rebranded as Star Metro and new journalists were hired. In its latest quarterly report, Torstar reported a 12% drop in revenue and a $41 million loss. As such, despite the claims that the company will be pushing in a new digital direction, it's more likely that this is just a cost-cutting measure. This leaves BC with just three daily print news publishers.
Thanks, Armon. The pilot story for what's going on with Why We March, the series, which is about the conflicts involving students here in Hong Kong and students abroad who are trapped now abroad. And so another member of the Democracy Watch, Serena Zhang, will be adding to the story as the events unfold. For those who aren't super aware of what's going on in Hong Kong, basically over 150 years ago, Great Britain fought China over trade during the Opium Wars. At the end of the wars, China gave up a small mountainous island off their coast to Great Britain as part of the peace treaty. The agreement was that this island, Hong Kong, would be under British rule for 99 years, ending in 1997. During this 99-year period of British rule, Hong Kong exploded in population and became a financial hub of Asia. When Britain gave Hong Kong back to China in 1997, they agreed that Hong Kong would have complete autonomy, meaning they could govern themselves, through something called a one-country, two-systems model, lasting until 2047, 50 years later. Hong Kongers have proudly held the title of the most free economy in the world, while China, who is stated on their official government website, is a communist country and therefore has much less of a free economy and a very different legal system. Here to elaborate on what's going on in Hong Kong, David Wong, who is a third-year political science student on exchange and currently a spokesman at UBC's Enlightenment of Hong Kong and the former president of Hong Kong University Student Union, is here in the studio right now. So thank you for coming in tonight.
Hi, everyone.
So can you tell us why exactly people are protesting in Hong Kong?
So the series of protests actually sparked off in June, specifically on the 9th of June. And at that time, people in Hong Kong were actually protesting against the extradition law amendment bills, which if the Legislative Council, the legislature in Hong Kong, passed the bill that would allow the chief executive, Carrie Lam, to extradite any fugitive to China. So that kind of was a threat, if not a breach, to Hong Kong people's constitutional protection from the Chinese judicial system, especially the criminal judicial system, because Hong Kong people have no trust in it, given like many words or news about how unjust and unfair were trials in China. But as the protests have been developing, and also as the bill has now been withdrawn, aim and also a focus of the protesters actually shifted from the extradition laws amendment bill to police brutality and also invasion of Chinese government intervention, along with a lot of, as we can see, the excessive force and also excessive violence brought by the police against protesters, and also along with a lot of accusations of mysterious murders and sexual assaults against protesters inside the police station while detaining protesters. So the aim and also the focus of the protest now shifts onto the police, and also I would say a bit on the legitimacy of the government itself.
So do you think like this, the extradition bill that you mentioned earlier, is China doing like a direct interference in Hong Kong judicial system?
Well, we did not, and actually we currently do not have any conclusive evidence that points right at the Chinese Communist Party that they want the extradition law amendment bill to pass. Because at the very first place, when the extradition law amendment bills sparked a debate in Hong Kong, actually the Chinese government reveals responsibility and say that, oh, it was Carrie Lam's idea to introduced this bill. It was not our thing. And but right now, as the bill was already withdrawn, people's the debate over the extradition laws amendment bill actually diminished. But the debate on police brutality was, I would say, on its peak right now.
Okay. And so over time, like the growth of cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou have grown exponentially, and therefore the GDP of the country, of like China, has grown as well with them. And as of 2018, Hong Kong now makes up a smaller percentage of China's total GDP. Do you think that that has a role in China's push to respect Hong Kong's autonomy less?
I would say, first of all, the high autonomy guaranteed by the Basic Law is a promise of the Chinese government. So, but of course, as like I think some of you may have watched the South Park episode "Banned in China," and China could really use some integrity. Okay, and then we're not sure. We are not confident that whether Chinese government will really hold their promise, as we can see for the past 20 years, actually, like the Chinese government is trying to breach the borderline of autonomy in Hong Kong. But Hong Kong does have a very special role that other cities in China doesn't have. Is the special tax status that enjoyed by Hong Kong, which makes a majority of foreign capital in China actually flows to other countries through Hong Kong, because like they can pay less tax in Hong Kong while it is legally within the territory of China. So I would safely say Hong Kong will not be replaced by other major cities in China in the coming decades, but certainly the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act just passed by the Congress in US does pose a threat to China in attempting to breach the borderline of autonomy of Hong Kong furthermore.
And why do you think like students here are protesting versus like, you know, abroad where they have, obviously you see the protesters abroad, but like why here on UBC's campus?
First of all, I think it is like a global trend. Like every Hong Kong student is in like other places, for example, the UK, the US, Australia, or even Korea, Japan, they are all protesting for Hong Kong protesters. And I think Vancouver actually has a rather special role, especially given its special relationship with Hong Kong. First of all, Hong Kongers have a very strong and special community rooted in Vancouver, especially after 1969, after the Tiananmen massacre, a lot of Hong Kong people actually migrate to Vancouver, and then that's like the start of a very strong Hong Kong community in Vancouver. That's why you can see not only on UBC campus, but a lot of protests supporting Hong Kong protesters happening in Vancouver City, in maybe Burnaby, and also Victoria. And then second, I would say Canada has a really special relationship with Hong Kong, given, for example, the people here and also the community here. And if we talk more realistically about the money here, because this is some figure. In 2017, Hong Kong was actually Canada's second most popular destination for investment in Asia. And Hong Kong direct investment in Canada actually like piled up to 12.4 billion in that period. So Hong Kong and Canada actually has a very close relationship over finance, and also I would say community over the people as well.
And the protests like that are going on in Hong Kong, and you see with like lots of violence, and like what is like, why are the protesters around big universities and like blocking off entrances, and why is like all this going on college campuses or university campuses there versus like just in the downtown like business district?
Well, I think the tension between the government and students actually started to, like, the tension between them started to increase and also exemplified since 2014, the Occupy Central movement, and or some say the Umbrella Revolution, because at that time the Umbrella Revolution was actually like kind of majorly led by student activists, and that was the time where tension between the government and students came to its peak. And I think until now, the government also still sees students as one of the major threats to their regime legitimacy, and they see student activists as a major part in all the protests that happened over the past 5 months. That's why back in June, there were already rumors that police tried to invade and search university campuses, and that just kind of came to realization in the past 2 weeks.
And finally, what would you say to students who are here at UBC and who are from the Chinese mainland, like, who have spoken out like against the protests necessarily or about them? Like, what would you say to those students here that might not necessarily disagree, but kind of feel somewhat threatened by the protests going on?
Well, first of all, I would say UBC is I'm very lucky to be in UBC because I have spoken to some students from China, and although they're like prima facie against what we stand for, especially as a part of a Hong Kong concern group, but they are willing to listen and they're willing to know more about what's going on in Hong Kong. And I think this is a really good attitude, and I think we should keep it in mind, especially while we are on this campus. And I also would think students from, no matter you're from China or from any other regions, if you're enjoying freedom and democracy right now, enjoy it to its fullness. And you, like, if you have doubt about what information you're receiving from the media in your country, look at many other media in Canada. They're really trustworthy and they're really doing a great job. So watch the news.
I have a follow-up question.
Yeah, sure.
You talked a lot about, you know, why you're doing these protests. At one level, you know, there are these very immediate kind of concerns about police brutality and about this extradition treaty. Also, there's also a larger question of, you know, the long-term future of Hong Kong. And even presently in Hong Kong, you don't have a fully democratic system of government. So I wish you could just talk a bit more about, you know, the big picture versus and how that relates to the smaller picture.
Yeah, actually, one of the demands, one of the slogan the protesters hold very dear in this series of protests was five demands, not one less. So one of the demands was to implement an authentic, they would say authentic, democracy in Hong Kong. Because right now, the chief executive was appointed by the Chinese government, and we all know that like the legislature was not reformed by a democratic manner. And
Sorry to interrupt you. Could you just explain a bit more, like, just for our listener to understand, how is the chief executive chosen, and like how the legislature, because some people vote. So just explain like who gets to vote and who gets to decide.
Well, let me try to briefly explain that, because that took me like a 2-week lecture to fully explain it. But the chief executive was actually chosen or elected, as stated in the basic law, that the chief executive was elected by a group of an election committee that formed by 1,200 people from different sectors in Hong Kong, while most of them are pro-Beijing. And even though, let's say, if we're really lucky that a lot of pro-Hong Kong people get into this nomination or election committee, after all, the chief executive has to be appointed by the Chinese government. So the chief executive has to vow in front of Xi Jinping. And then, and for the legislature, although there are a part of seats that are democratically elected, that constitute less than around half of them only. And less than half of the seats were held by the pro-democratic sector for the past few years. And while if we look at the statistic of popular vote, actually over 80% of electorates in Hong Kong voted for the pro-democratic parties in Hong Kong. Yeah, so that's kind of like the so-called semi-democratic system in Hong Kong doesn't really work.
Yeah, I see. And so that's part of the five demands. One of them is to have a more representative democratic system.
Yes, and that is, I would say, the most the demand that appears to be the most problematic to most protesters, because right now we do not have a blueprint yet, and we do not have any concrete plan for it. But what protesters believe, I think was that the government actually has the responsibility to provide us any proposal. So stop asking protesters for proposal. It's your duty.
So yeah, that is like very interesting. So it's just like the police also are just not being very fair with the protesters. A lot of police violence, as you said.
Yeah.
And it's just more dangerous for everyone, I guess.
Actually, one of the most significant accusations of sexual assault brought by protesters was brought by a student from Chinese University of Hong Kong. She was Sonia Ng, and she was a Canadian.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, it's just very unfortunate, I would say. It's just tough. But anyway, thank you for, speaking with us about what's going on. And we really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
If you're listening, or if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Zachary Tharp, and I give a background of the history of Hong Kong, as well as spoke with David Wong, who is a Hong Kong activist here at UBC as part of Democracy Watch's newest series, Why We March, which covers the ongoing protests here on campus. Up next, we will be covering the ongoing strike that encompasses all of Metro Vancouver. But first, a few words from our sponsors.
Bah, humbug. A modern adaptation of A Christmas Carol celebrates the downtown Eastside community in its 10th annual and final season. It's the perfect family holiday treat, filled with rock, blues, and Christmas carols. Plus, enjoy live music from a youth choir. opens December 5th at SFU Woodwards, located at 149 West Hastings Street. For tickets and details, visit sfuwoodwards.ca.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Democracy Watch bringing you undercovered current affairs from the Lower Mainland. We just learned some big news this week, and it's that...
it's a transit strike.
Yeah, okay. It's about the transit strike. Sorry, I got thrown off. Anyway, point is, me, Isa Yu, and Alex Tribulsi, as well as Armand Rana, spoke with campus residents on Monday on their reaction to the strike.
Do you know why this transit workers are striking, and what do you think about it?
Yeah, for their rights, because they have no time to do anything in between breaks or even have time. I mean, they work overtime and then maybe they're not paid enough because they feel like they're being overworked, basically, and they don't have time to themselves.
I just know that their breaks aren't long enough, and like they're working too much overtime, and so they don't want to do that anymore. And so, like, I know, like, the strike is basically that they're not going to work overtime and they're not going to wear their uniforms, and that's about it.
So currently I know that the main thing that has been affected would be probably the CBUS, so people who are traveling from North End to possibly to downtown area. It seems that in more downtown areas, the buses have not been affected too much yet, especially during peak hours. But if we continue, then we would be quite affected in general, I feel like.
I think so. I was speaking with, sometimes I speak with some of the operators, and they talk about primarily their having a break, in between break, their schedule. Specifically, I asked about the new transit exchange and then the operators. They have this facility over here, and how he liked it, and quite interestingly, one of the guys, he said that he's never had the opportunity to be in it because he's always late, behind in his schedule, so he needs to just keep driving. So I guess it really hit home as to what exactly they're striking about.
They're striking for their salary and their rest time, right? For the bus drivers, sometimes they're overloaded for their work and they couldn't get enough time for their rest and they couldn't get a salary.
Do you support the transit strike?
Like, yeah, like personally, no, because like it would have a huge impact on like students and that kind of stuff. But like, if they want things to change, I feel like they need drastic measures. Yeah, so I guess it would be okay if it was like a reasonable time period, maybe like after exams. So I don't know, timing wise.
So has your life been negatively impacted so far?
It's affecting everyone, like all commuters, and it's like, isn't pretty much the union isn't getting like a fair deal from their employers, so that's why they're doing the strike.
Not really, because I drive, I just like park on 16th, so I just take a bus like four stops.
I work in Civic Center, so every Monday and Friday and Saturday, I have to take a bus to work. And since the strike has begun, and I feel a little bit stressed about the transit time to go to work, so it really has impacts on people's life.
What would you think a justifiable escalation would be?
Definitely not a full blown like strike because exams are coming. But after that, I wouldn't mind. what stage three be? I don't know, one thing I've thought about is like how Japan's trans workers are striking, how they're not accepting fares. That'd be interesting to see. I don't know how feasible that is, but...
You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard from commuters about their thoughts on the transit strike. That piece was edited by Alex Trabulsi. And yeah, and so then I caught up with Gavin McGarrigal, Unifort Regional Director and a negotiator representing the bus drivers in this transit negotiations. Let's hear what he had to say about what's coming next. To start off, could you share with our listeners who you are and what Unifort's role is?
Sure. My name is Gavin McGarrigal. I'm Unifort's Western Regional Director. I'm involved as a lead negotiator in the Coast Mountain Bus Translink bargaining that's going on right now.
You recently stated that transit workers will engage in a full system strike starting next Wednesday if an agreement is not reached. What led you to take this step?
Well, we've been trying not to have any impact on the passengers or the students. We know that that's who we serve. This is the first time in 18 years that we've taken any kind of job action. You know, the issues with the increase in ridership has gone up about 18% over the past number of years, and the overcrowding has increased by 36%. So our members take care of students every day, and they see them, you know, being left out in the rain while they're trying to get up to UBC. You know, sometimes two, three, and four full buses pass them by, and then when they do get on the bus, they're crammed in there like sardines. So there's a lot of pressure on the passengers and on the workers as well, because we see increased assaults. We see less and less time being allocated for them to have a break at the end of the line to be able to go to the washroom or have a bite to eat or just simply reset themselves. And, you know, they're not robots, they're humans. So the pressures have been building for quite some time. And our members voted after, you know, several rounds of negotiations, 99.3% in favor of strike action to support the bargaining committee. And we continued even after that on a number of sessions. So finally, for the first time in 18 years, we served strike notice after 29 separate sessions of bargaining with the company. And really, we were focused on working conditions, wages, and benefits. And, you know, we look at the overpaid, unaccountable executives at TransLink and Coast Mountain Bus Company, and not only were they unwilling to talk about minimum break times, for these operators to go to the bathroom or to simply reset themselves, they didn't want to talk about wage comparisons. They're trying to compare them to nurses and firefighters instead of comparing transit workers to transit workers. And so when you look, for instance, at what the companies did, TransLink and Coast Mountain Bus Company, with respect to CEO compensation, the CEO of Coast Mountain Bus Company is set to receive an 18% wage increase to about $372,000 a year. That's more than the Prime Minister makes. And the CEO of TransLink, Kevin Desmond, is set to receive a 25% wage increase to you know, over $500,000 a year. This is more than the executives, for instance, at places like the Toronto Transit Commission make. So they're paying themselves and patting themselves on the back for the great job that they're doing, and they talk to the mayor's council and show them shiny PowerPoint presentations, but they're not actually taking care of the workers. And, you know, when we look at comparisons of transit workers, we note that whatever way you look at it, the comparisons are not being done fairly. For instance, although they pay the executives in the Toronto Transit Commission much less than here, they pay the workers about $3 an hour more, and that's going to increase by 2% over the next 2 years. And so we've said that that's a valid comparison, and what we've asked to do is to close the gap with Toronto Transit for drivers. Not entirely. We know we're not going to get there in, you know, right away or overnight, but to basically take some significant steps to start closing that gap so that the major metropolitan cities are paying, you know, closer to the same. Because, of course, as students know as well, affordability issues are up for our members as they are for everyone else, and the cost of living is higher here than in Toronto. When you look at the comparisons within the system, under TransLink, TransLink doesn't treat its workers fairly, and they try to divide workers up into these separate companies when everyone knows it's all TransLink, whether you're on the SkyTrain or whether you're on the bus. And so, you know, what they do is they pay the skilled trades people who have red seals, who are, you know, ticketed electricians and heavy-duty mechanics. And at SkyTrain, they pay them about $3 an hour more, while over at Coast Mountain Bus Company, they pay them less. They try to pretend that they're separate companies and divide them up when, again, it's all TransLink. So whether you make comparisons within the system or with other places, you know, they're simply not treating their workers fairly. And so the anger has gotten to the point where they've had to take action. And we know the public and many students have spoken out and sent hundreds and hundreds of thousands of messages to TransLink, but they don't seem to be getting the message. And so we escalated this week and last week to limited days of an overtime ban for drivers, which has had more of an impact. But ultimately, all we saw from TransLink is them putting out new spokespeople all the time, continuing to attack the workers, continuing to claim they want to go back to the bargaining table, claim they want to engage in mediation. But the reality is they're not accountable to anyone. And, you know, that's why we're asking the public to speak up. So, you know, unfortunately, we have had to move to a three-day strike next week. You know, we're going to go back to work after that. And we hope that that sort of wakes them up, that the public is on our side, the students are on our side. And at the end of the day, nobody wants to see this thing continue, least of all the workers.
Yeah. So you mentioned the three-day strike next week. What would that look like for transit users?
So what that will mean is that there will be no bus system in Metro Vancouver at all. And on any runs, SkyTrain will still be operating, although I noticed the SkyTrain workers just delivered their union 96.8% strike mandate today as well. But basically, that will mean for those 3 days that there will be no conventional or shuttle bus service throughout Metro Vancouver.
I see. So you mentioned students. We are, as you know, a campus radio. So on Monday, we spoke to a bunch of students and other campus residents who use the bus frequently. And we found that they were generally somewhat supportive of the bus driver strike so far, especially about the concerns about working conditions. However, many expressed concerns about the possibility of an ongoing and intensified job action during the exam period starting on December 3rd here at UBC. How do you factor these kind of concerns into your decision making?
Well, again, we support the students. They're riding the bus every day. We know how hard it is. They need to get an education. We also support the call of the student society throughout the region to tell university and college administrators to give the students some leniency, you know, not just leave it up to individual professors to decide whether or not people will be penalized for missing classes or exams. They should schedule around this. This is a very unusual event, and they shouldn't just leave it up to different professors to make amends. They should put out policies that say, listen, students, we know that this is unusual. We're going to work with you. We're going to work around this. We're not going to penalize you for this because, of course, it's not the students' fault that this is happening. The drivers have tried to do everything they can to avoid escalating to this point. So one of the things we are doing is next Thursday, November 28th at 1 o'clock at the TransLink headquarters in New Westminster. We're going to be calling for a mass public rally. The workers will be there. Our national president, Jerry Dias, will be there. We're inviting student associations and others to come and speak and join us. And we think that you know, these unaccountable executives need to get the message that the public is supportive, and this is an opportunity to do it so that it doesn't continue past the three-day strike. We don't even want to have to go to that level, but ultimately, if the executives continue to put their fingers in their ears and not listen to the real concerns, that we're going to have to continue to escalate. But we think the administration should be a lot more lenient on the message they're giving students.
Yeah, what I was trying to get at with that question was when you try and schedule a strike or make these kind of decisions, do you kind of schedule it as to have a bigger impact, or do you avoid certain high demand periods, or is that not a factor?
We're really just following the bargaining process. I mean, our contract expired on March 31st. For various reasons, we didn't end up going to bargaining until August 1st. We put in those 29 sessions, and it just, you know, we've been trying to do this limited job action. It just really organically rose, and really the decision to escalate was not based on having any particular impact. We know the bus system is important pretty much any time of the year. It was really based on the fact that the company simply wasn't serious about dealing with the issues, and that's why we had to escalate.
I see. And you mentioned the SkyTrain workers earlier. Do you think that the potential for a SkyTrain strike adds any pressure for a resolution to be proposed sooner?
Well, I think, it certainly adds pressure, but it's also a sign that something is badly wrong at TransLink. Why is it that these two groups of workers are now giving such overwhelming mandates, 99% and 96%, to their unions and with the real threat of action? You've seen not one iota of acceptance of responsibility by the executives there. And so they're paying themselves, huge wages, saying that they care about the passengers, and yet the very workers that are running the system are extremely upset and saying you're not listening. So, it is going to be an impact, and, I would not be surprised if SkyTrain workers do end up taking strike action, because this company, they're just out of touch with the realities on the ground, both for the passengers, the students, and the workers.
I see. And the Coast Mountain Bus Company states on their Buzzer blog that wages remain the main sticking point between the two parties. Would you consider that accurate?
No, of course not. There are many issues on the table. This is a contract that covers 5,000 workers, and this is a classic example of how they're misleading the public again. The reality is, we don't have an agreement on working conditions, and the company knows that. That we made some progress last week when we were in negotiations, but there was still a lot of work to be done. So we don't have an agreement on that. We don't have an agreement on wages, and there are numerous other proposals that are still out there on the table that need to be addressed. So again, the company is out there misleading the public, trying to claim it's all about wages when they know full well that they don't have any agreement on working conditions. So we have some good ideas that we're talking about, but we don't have an agreement.
So one of the issues that outside of wages that seems to come up a lot in this discussion around the transit strike is that of bathroom breaks. Can you just explain for me and for our listeners, is it a matter of lack of bathroom infrastructure, scheduling, incentives, accessibility issues, or all four? And just elaborate a bit more about that.
Sure. The bathroom issue is really all of those issues. What's happened is drivers are allocated with something known as running time, which is the amount of time to get to from point A to point B. So what you find is when you have the increased ridership and the overcrowding, the time that they've allocated is not sufficient. And so what happens is because the drivers are trying to serve the customers first and foremost, they are, going to skip their bathroom breaks. They're just simply not going to have enough time. On top of that, we haven't seen enough of a focus on making sure that there's, enough staff allocated to make sure the bathrooms are kept clean and stocked. And on top of that, they haven't really allocated enough resources to make sure that there are enough bathrooms and that they are, in good quality. I mean, I think people would be shocked to know that there are actually porta potties that our members have to use. And this isn't something on a temporary basis. This is a ongoing permanent solution. So, again, they've just squeezed and squeezed and squeezed the amount of time out, what they call recovery time. But the recovery time is for the bus to stop. So as one example, when they pull up to the UBC loop, it's all monitored by GPS. And so the minute that they pull up to the loop, the system says, okay, you've arrived, so now you're having time to go to the bathroom. But in fact, the bus is still pulling up, still stopping, parking, waiting for the passengers to unload, checking for lost property, et cetera. And all of that time is considered rest time. Then they have to walk over to the bathroom. And, of course, there's only so many bathrooms, so if someone else is using it, they have to wait. So this issue has been building for years and years and years, and they're simply treating the workers like robots instead of humans.
How receptive has the Coast Mountain Bus Company been to these specific concerns about bathrooms?
They really started the bargaining by basically refusing to address it at all. They simply didn't want to talk about it. They said, we'll put in more aggregate hours across the system to address it. But we kept asking them one simple question. Tell us, what is the minimum guaranteed break time that every driver has on any given day. I mean, people who are working, you know, in fast food or restaurants or anywhere, pretty much anyone, union or non-union, knows that they're going to get a certain break every day. Occasionally things go wrong and you miss your break, but on a day-to-day basis, people can count on some level of a break. But there was actually no minimum break time written into the contract at all for these drivers. And so, you know, they couldn't answer the question, what is each driver going to get on each day? Because all they wanted to talk about was overall hours across the entire system. And that simply didn't work. So it took a long time to even get them to start talking about it at all. They didn't get any kind of serious proposals on the table until well into this job action. We did, as I said, make some progress on it last week, but the distinction between recovery time and break time needs to be ironed out. We need to land on some bathroom language and make sure that we've addressed the issue definitively so that every worker knows what their minimum break is going to be every day.
Thanks so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up?
No, we just like to invite all of the students to please join us at the rally at TransLink next Thursday, November 28th. We want your voices to be heard. We want this brought to an end, and we think the bigger that rally is, the stronger the message will be. And we thank all the students who've reached out to us so far with their ongoing support. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, right. Thanks, Armand.
Thursday? Next Thursday.
And you're back on CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch. So we just heard a piece, an interview with the leader of Unifor, Gavin McGargle, and we also heard from some campus residents about their feelings about the upcoming transit strike and the ongoing transit strike. And I found it really interesting. We're going to kind of switch gears here now. We're going to have a piece about Criticare. But before that, we're going to take a quick ad break. And here you go.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, Homasquim, Mustail.
When the forces of white heteropatriarchal capitalism try to get you down, 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 down. If that's what you wanna do, do. Bechdel Test Burlesque is here to lift you up with a jam-packed, star-studded evening of pop culture critique powered by Thrill Joy Feminism. After 6 years of sold-out shows from Seattle to the University of Oregon, Bechdel Test Burlesque is coming to Vancouver with an international intersectional coalition of nerdy feminists to prove that rebellions are built on hope. One night only at the Rio Theater on November 30th. This show is not to miss. Check out riotheatertickets.com for more information and to buy tickets. We can go crazy and the pop.
As the days grow shorter, the first autumn chill sets in, and leaves start gathering in seemingly perpetual piles, the joys of summer can seem to be a distant memory. But at Criticare Wildlife Society in Langley, there's always a bright spot, even as winter approaches. Established over 30 years ago, this wildlife rehabilitation center has been treating, housing, and subsequently releasing injured or orphaned BC mammals. Over the years, they prepared countless animals for re-entry into the wild through the dedication of their wonderful interns, staff, volunteers, and veterinary partners. My name is Adeline Payne. This past July, I stopped by Criticare's annual open house. I took a tour that gave me a glimpse of the center's various animal habitats, such as the raccoon, otter, beaver, and deer enclosures, as well as the nursery housing infant mammals. In part one of this series, we explored the nursery and raccoon enclosures. Today, we'll take a look at the otter and beaver habitats, as well as the bear and fawn enclosures. After that, we'll cover the ins and outs of transporting rescued animals with Norm Snyher, a helicopter pilot who volunteers his time to ensure that rescued animals are transported to critter care quickly and safely. Next, we stop by the Education Center and the Bear Enclosure. As one of only four wildlife centers in BC that are licensed to rehabilitate bears, Critter Care has seen a huge influx of cubs this summer after their mothers were put down after becoming used to human food sources. This includes garbage, food left out in parks, and other items with a strong smell that attract bears. Here at Critter Care, cubs are taught essential skills for surviving in the wild, such as climbing and foraging. In the fall, they also start to prepare them for hibernation.
So this is our education center. I don't know why. Well, we used to have a teacher that would give classes to.
We got it starting up again.
Is it?
Yeah,
awesome.
This woman is going to start doing it. She's already done something.
That's wonderful, because you know what? Us old fogies aren't going to change things, but these kids are. So we're going to go right through past where you guys were sitting and waiting for me, and then around, and we're going to see where we house our bears. You are not going to see any bears. For obvious reasons, we don't need them getting used to seeing faces like ours. I think we've got 15. I'm almost afraid to say that number, because when Maureen did up the notice, it was 12, and I think there's 15 now, right?
Yes.
They're coming in by
2015, where we had 32
bears. Yeah. It's kind of scary. Most of these ones, I believe, are garbage bears.
Just a second.
And that's not good.
Are they cubs or big?
Cubs. Mm-hmm. Moms have been killed,
yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we'll go through here. Bears, it's kind of scary because it's kind of almost like a repeat of year 32. The bears they will be kept and released. We try to hold them till after the hunting season, because obviously our bears, when they go out, are in prime condition. They hibernate here, but then they go out and hunt and say, whoa! So we try to wait till after the hunting season. The three bears that have been released from this pen, they've left it open to you guys. Whatever is kind of cool, so you can see the inside of it.
I'm here, so.
I got the three for you guys.
Heading down the path from the bear enclosure, we explore the otter and beaver habitats. These feature outdoor pools to strengthen the animals' swimming and fishing skills.
I've never been to a human zoo before. All these people in cages, it's weird.
Yeah,
this is their outdoor pool. We've got it closed off right now, but you'll notice there's a tunnel connecting.
Yeah, they were just in their little pool.
And the beaver, I was staggered to know. I didn't know this, but we keep them for 2 years. That's
how long they're in.
Yeah.
They have a tea in there. Oh, they have a
water. Yeah, just like in the tub, right?
I mean, obviously, it's like a metal beaver.
Yeah.
What are their names?
Yeah,
the otters are Luna hilarious.
Finally, we arrive at the fawn enclosure, where we're greeted by its curious residents. Since interns have to be in close contact with fawns while raising them, Critter Care tries to introduce them to other fawns as soon as possible, so that they won't become too used to humans. They also invented a milk bar, which features a platform with a row of bottles. This promotes independent feeding habits.
Around the corner we've got our 14 fawns, so you just want to keep your voices down.
Kayla?
She said we have to keep our voices down.
Oh my goodness, there's so many. Take a picture.
It's a problem when you have that many.
You know what?
It's
nice to have, but then... I wonder how many come in that don't have to be here. Because people see them abandoned, and they're not abandoned.
Well, yeah. Coming right over for a look.
And you'll note in the back, you see that kind of wooden structure?
Mm-hmm.
We're trying now to not hand feed them.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll put the bottles in those wooden structures and have the meat out of that instead of...
That's good.
Some, obviously, they're too sick and weak. We do have to hand feed them. But they look pretty cute, but all of them still with their spots.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
They were all right here.
Oh yeah.
You guys, after we finish here, we're going to go out the gate, and that's actually the end of our tour.
Okay.
I do want to thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know how long you had to wait.
We have 14.
After the tour, I speak with Norm Snyher, a former commercial airline pilot who now volunteers as a helicopter pilot, transporting animals to critter care and other wildlife rehabilitation centers.
Thanks for taking the time to chat with me today. Would you mind letting me know your name and your role in assisting wildlife rescues?
Yeah, my name is Norman Snyher, and it's written on the side of my helicopter up there. I transport injured and releasable wildlife to and from where they were found to a wildlife facility. And I also do rescues. I land wherever there's a problem catching an injured animal. I can land beside it and transport it to a facility. And I've been doing that for since 1994. I'm retired now, so it gives me a worthwhile activity in my retirement. And it really helps the animals. I can transport an animal from the other end of the island in an hour, which would take several hours for a volunteer to drive it. So it helps recovery, and it's a valuable experience for the wildlife centers too, because they don't have to have volunteers tied up for all day moving an animal. I can do it in an hour. So.
I see. So have you ever flown up to the Northern Lights Wildlife Society up in Smithers?
No, as far as I go is to Pemberton, to Tofino, and Campbell River. Helicopters are not designed to travel long distances, so I could fly up there, but it would take me all day. So I stay within about an hour and a half from where I'm based. And that's the most efficient use of the helicopter.
So that's the average amount of time to go to, let's say, Pemberton, right? Like maximum an hour.
An hour and 10 minutes from Nanaimo, where I'm based. And I can get to most of the rescues or transport locations from Nanaimo in about an hour and a bit. So.
I understand that when bear cubs are very small, you could possibly take two in that crate.
There's two bear cubs in that building that I could carry four of those, because they're only as big as a cat. But most of the ones that need rescuing are bigger. And I've never actually carried a bear cub because I've never been asked to, unless they were too big for me to carry.
I see. So what's the biggest mammal or raptor that you have carried so far?
Swan, a pelican. Biggest mammal is a beaver, and biggest bird is an eagle.
I understand there was one instance where an eagle got loose. So what kind of modifications did you make afterward in terms of transport?
In that instance, the aged volunteer had it wrapped in a blanket and were holding it like a baby. And it started flapping its wings and it escaped. After that, I wrapped the wings in a cloth, put a hood on it, and I secured the talons with tape so that even if it got out, it couldn't harm anybody, and they're transported that way. And then when I go to a place where it's to be released, say I'll just release it from all the bindings and off it flies. But the nice thing about a helicopter is I can transport them in half an hour to an hour, whereas if they, before this, they had to be transported by road and ferry, so it took hours and hours, so the survival rate was much higher with helicopter transport because they're looked after much sooner. So it's really helpful for wildlife. In the summer, they're in a crate for several hours if they have to go any distance. When I'm flying it, the air is cool, and it's much better conditions for them when they're injured.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for all your service for these critters in need. Nice meeting you, too. Yeah, thank you for all the insight.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. This piece was reported and produced by Adeline Ping. Special thanks to Critter Care Wildlife Society and CITR 101.9 FM.
You just listened to a Critter Care piece by Adeline Ping. If you just tuned in, this is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Unceded Airwaves. But for next week, or we air every week at 5 p.m. tune in next week for Democracy Watch.